Welcome to the Natural Running Network. We are brought to you by Mio, makers of the world's first strapless heart rate monitor sports watches, and MedHab, makers of RPM Squared, an innovative system of gait analysis that slips right into your running shoes. My name is Richard Diaz. I am your host. Are you a runner? Do you love to get out and challenge yourself? Running your first marathon, or maybe caught the bug of obstacle racing? Well, sit tight, because this is a show you just don't want to miss. The topic of today's show is training the dark side, or lactate tolerance training. This is a topic that I thought was very entertaining, and for a lot of the athletes that are participating in obstacle racing and these high intensity events, they're very confused about the process, and I thought it would be cool to not only do this show and discuss it with my dear friend, Dr. Harry Pino, who's an exercise scientist from New Jersey, but to offer up a PDF file free of charge to anyone that visits the naturalrunningnetwork.com and subscribes to the podcast. They're going to get a copy. While I'm on the subject, I want to give a shout out to our sponsors, Meal Global, makers of Mio Alpha and Mio Fuse, heart rate monitors that do not require chest straps. You can find the link on my website if you're interested in more information about them. And MedHab. MedHab makes a training insole that provides data, feedback from what's actually happening when you make contact with the ground. Very, very innovative stuff here. We're talking about force production, power output, cadence, flight time. It's just an amazing tool for those that are interested in trying to improve their running skills. So let's do this show. I am here with my dear friend, Dr. Harry Pino, and he is off in the East Coast right now in his office preparing to do a VO2 max test on one of his clients. And so, Harry, why don't you say hello to our audience?
Hello, everyone. Nice to be with you too, Richard.
Yeah. So, Harry, tell us a little bit about the client you got coming.
Her name is, I just could say her first name, Rolanda. she's a former Olympian, 800 meters. She represented country of Panama. So she's trying to get back after having a baby. So she's trying to get back and get ready to run some races. So cool. She needs a VO2.
Well, this is interesting, you know, and I should let people know that this is completely coincidental and accidental. I didn't know that you were getting ready to do a test right now, and I appreciate that I pulled you away for a few minutes to discuss this topic. And the topic being what I call training the dark side. The dark side, in my mind, being what occurs when you get above your lactate threshold from a standpoint of training or racing, which is, in my opinion, a critical component of your training and often misunderstood.
Absolutely. I have to agree with that. It's and sometimes that misconception could bring the athletes in, could get them in a lot of trouble too.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a lot of people I'm working with these days that are into high intensity events. They're doing these obstacle races, and the nature of an obstacle race is that, you know, you run till you get to an obstacle, then you have to do some high intensity type of strength move. Then you have to run to the next obstacle. And you continue this type of activity from either a 5K in the sprint events right on up to a half marathon. And in some cases, these events, I know that the World Championships for Spartan is going to occur at Lake Tahoe. So now what we're doing is we're adding altitude to the complexity of the thing. So clearly this is a very important element of training for someone that is going to be going out hard, having to stay at this relatively high intensity and maintain their capacity to perform.
Yeah, it's that's the the new thing in. It's a coincidence also. We have a couple of, we sponsor a couple of Spartan guys in, at the clinic, at the former clinic I was in. And it's interesting how they train. It's good and bad, I guess, because you're young, you could handle it. But if you have a middle-aged guy or some guys our age trying to do this, it could be painful. So I do agree that it's definitely high intensity. It's all out, and I mean, they have incredible lactate tolerance, but I'm more concerned with their aerobic capacity, which that's another topic. But it's pretty interesting how they come in. Sometimes we, and I think you had an experience several weeks ago doing a test on one of your athletes, and it was very interesting results.
yeah, to put it mildly.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
But let's talk about that for just a second. Now, you suggested that I'm trying to read between the lines. And I think you're trying to be politically correct in what you're trying to say, but there's a lot of misconceptions in respect to the approach to training in regards to preparing for events like this. And so mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of guys are getting involved in this hypoxic training where they're mm-hmm. wearing these sport masks to shunt their ability to get efficient respiration while they're putting themselves to task. And, you know, all of these things that are really, really inhibiting and expensive efforts. And not to suggest that there's not a place for that type of training, but it should not be your staple in life.
I have to agree with that. I am trying to be politically correct because, you know, it's... But the type of, or the method of training for this type of event, it's pretty, obviously it's intense, but again, it's the amount of injuries we see with this type of event, it's incredible. It's incredible. Based on some research we have done, I think the amount of injuries, it's around 74 to 76% of all these athletes that are participating in this type of event, and mostly comes from a musculoskeletal standpoint. They just don't stretch much, and they just really their warm ups. I know you're dealing with a lot of them now, but their warm ups, it's not like your typical warm up for a runner or even a middle distance runner. It's just they power everything in their warm-ups. It's amazing. It's amazing.
Well, I guess the thing we're trying to say here, and I agree with you, is that there's a better way to approach this type of training. And, you know, I've been around it lately, Harry, and mm-hmm. I've been around some of the top athletes in the sport, and they're all really very, very eager and hungry for information. Because mm-hmm. there is not a lot of information in respect to the proper approach to training for these sports, because the sport mm-hmm. is really pretty much in its infancy. So that's really kind of what brought me to it, is the fascination of, you know, the approach to the sport. And, these people are very eager. I mean, I'll tell you what, I've been around a lot of athletes in my life, and I've yet to run into a group with more enthusiasm and grit than the people that participate in these obstacle races. So
yeah,
it's pretty cool. So it's what caused me to write this little paper that I refer to as Training the Dark Side. Because obviously there's a necessity to develop this anaerobic metabolism to survive and thrive in these types of events. So what I want to do is first, if we could, and I know I'm going to go ahead and apologize for pulling you out of your office, and we have a limited amount of time with you, and I want to use your time wisely. So what I want to do is first kind of introduce people to exactly what this is, lactate, and you know what the processes are, And, you know, I don't know who better to have discuss this with me than someone that has a PhD in exercise science. So let's just kind of kick it around a little bit here. Lactate is a natural occurring function of metabolism. And I think that a lot of people are confused about what this substance is and what it causes to have happen. And, you know, I think that what's really critical to understand is, first of all, it is not a function of this lactic acid that is causing you to have this delayed onset muscle soreness 2 days later. A lot of people think that the reason they're sore after a couple days workout, that they still have all this lactic acid in their muscles. I've even heard people talk about doing flushing exercises, you know, a day or two later to move out the lactic acid. And you know, you and I both know, Harry, or at least I want to go out on a limb and assume you'll agree with me, is that if you're still experiencing a tremendous amount of lactic acid buildup 2 days after an event, you had better go see a doctor.
Yes, you're starting to have, yes, absolutely. There's muscle damage going on. And I have to agree with you, too. It's a misconception. I mean, lactic acid, believe it or not, I always say it's good for you.
It is good for you.
But, yes, but and it's sadly, specifically with the people we see as these high-end athletes, you know, they really get, and even they're pretty good athletes, but they're pretty much, they don't want to touch up that lactate. They get very concerned. I have several female runners that they love to be right below lactate, which is okay, but once in a while you have to push that envelope. And they're afraid they won't do it, and so we have to find ways, both as trainers and as unofficial psychologists, to deal with their mind and teaching these athletes that it's okay to go a little bit above that. You know, maybe if you have a 10-day cycle of training, maybe day three or day six, again, depending on your cycle. But this byproduct is it's good to understand. It's good to understand because you need this for your, if you're using heart rate training, you know, you need to understand it for your heart rate.
Well, at the end of the day, lactate is in the process of our, well, let's back up. As we combust energy, we produce lactate. As a component of this lactate production, we create glucose. And this glucose is either going to be pushed into our liver for use later days, or, you know, you're going to end up using it directly. So lactate is actually a supplemental energy source. But the problem with most people is that when they go over their threshold, they go so heavily into their threshold that the hydrogen ions that are associated with lactic acid production start to irritate the nerve endings. And then what ends up happening is it starts to shut them down, and then they fail. In my position paper, I quote Dr. Timothy Noakes, who has very eloquently described what he calls the central governor theory. And you know, your central governor or your central nervous system is always on guard to protect you from you harming yourself. And when you start to throw up signals that are contrary to your health, your central nervous system will start shutting muscle function down and keep you from producing more work. And the idea being it's trying to protect you from your being injured. But if you take it, and the comment I like to use, and I made reference to it in this paper, is I like to look at lactate tolerance training as like getting a flu shot. You take an inoculation, which is essentially a low dose of the virus that you're trying to develop an immunity towards, and your body learns to adapt to this low dose and progressively higher doses of this potential virus. So when you get over your lactate threshold, if you do it in an undulating fashion, you get up and you back up some of this lactate production with some aerobic conditioning, you're able to flush some of the excess waste from the working muscles.
Yeah.
And then you start to teach your body to learn to contend with ensuing waste production, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a very solid explanation, very solid. I mean, and again, most people, once they you know, the lactic threshold, for example, or above that, and we know from a clinical standpoint, normally it's around 20 beats per minute, about that steady state. But I have to agree with you, but most of these athletes, they want to train up there, especially in the new sports, Spartan races and these CrossFit. That's another example. Now they're adding more running into it, but they're running way up there. I mean, they're really reaching high. They're really putting 90% of effort, 95% effort. But their aerobic capacity is so low, they start fading quite a bit. And you're right, we have to start probably teaching this a little more to these athletes. There's a good reading that I recommend. You could look up as hydrogen and lactate and exercise, and you could just click on that, and there's pretty good article about these well-trained athletes that usually train below their lactate threshold, and then in their cycles they drop, they go between 5 and 10 minutes all out within that cycle, and they're all anaerobic, and they believe that that's the way to train. So I just came upon that article, and I'm still reading it, but it's pretty interesting, and it explains exactly what you're saying, Richard, about these exchanges in the body. So
what I've tried to create in this training plan is basically a tiptoe approach to becoming accustomed to this acidic environment that resides in the working muscles, as opposed to, you know, I liken it to beating your head against the wall. You're going to lose to the wall every time. And as you suggested, you go into a high-intensity event, it becomes a function of how much tolerance you've developed to this ensuing waste production. And if you do it all the time, you may be able to be more successful than the people you're competing with. But the true path to developing tolerance is, first of all, getting the lactate to be processed, as opposed to just trying to take the beating. Learn to contend with ensuing production of lactate. And through what is referred to as the lactate shuttle system, you start teaching your body how to mitigate the ensuing problem by shoving some of this lactic acid into regions of the body that are not working, and respirating some of it. I like to tell people it's like a relief valve. You blow some of it off in the form of carbon dioxide through your exhalation, and then you throw some of it back into your liver, and then it goes into your liver and it's processed into glucose and right back into energy source again. So that's the end game. And the path, I believe, to improving your capacity to do this is to, as I suggested, you tiptoe into it. So let me give you the four, or essentially the three stages or phases of training that I've created, and give me your thoughts on it, Harry.
Okay.
So first of all, when I get somebody new that is into this sport, the first thing I want to do with them is I want to try to improve their VO2 max. Okay. And so, and then incidentally, Harry, since I'm doing online coaching with athletes that I'll never meet, and I'm trying to help them develop good running skills, while they're doing a lot of base work, which is obviously what I prescribe, I have them do a lot of high-intensity intervals on a treadmill, but the treadmill is set up at about an 8% grade, and I have them doing 30-second repeats, and then I require that they allow their heart rate to come down to about 120 beats per minute before they produce another set.
Another set, yeah, perfect.
So ideally, is what we're doing is putting a lot of stress on the heart, which is going to cause it to become stronger, improve cardiac output, while allowing a lot of recovery time to flush a lot of that lactic acid out so that they, for the most part, it's an aerobic effort. And then, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, that's exactly the way to do it. I mean, if you don't also include workouts that challenges your system by doing just what you're doing, just below or to above the current lactic threshold levels, you will not maximize the ability for these short distance to long distance events. That's absolutely correct.
So then what I have them do is I do like a on one day on, one day off. One day off meaning that they're doing an aerobic workout. So if I did this high-intensity mm-hmm. workout today, tomorrow I'm going to do a 60-minute aerobic base run. Mm-hmm. So the actual volume of work that you're doing aerobically is still dominant. And incidentally, I haven't said it, but I should say it. The best way to improve lactate tolerance is to become more aerobic. And so your lactate threshold is going to go further and further north into your heart rate before mm-hmm. you start to become shut down by this acidic nature of this lactic acid development. So that's the 1-2 punch. You do these intervals at first at really high intensity with great recovery, and then they follow up on the following day with a nice, easy base run.
Mm-hmm.
And I have people do that for about 3 weeks. And then after that 3 weeks, what we do is we start increasing the time under tension. So instead of doing these high intensity 30-second intervals, now what we're doing is moderate intensity. So we have them go not quite as intense above threshold, but above threshold mm-hmm. for 90 seconds mm-hmm. and follow up with it. So the work ratio is now 1-1. In the beginning, okay. the work ratio was 1-2, so one part work, two times recovery, and then now we're going to do 1-1. So if I have you at 90 seconds above threshold at a moderate over threshold pace, I follow up with moderate aerobic recovery. The way I've done this, mm-hmm. and then assuming that most people aren't going to have a chance to be tested by you or I, mm-hmm. unfortunately. What I've done is I use Maffetone's formula where we take 180, subtract our age, and then mm-hmm. I have three levels of anaerobic metabolism. So I have them take 180, add 10 beats, and then low-intensity lactate tolerance training, they add 10 beats. And then moderate-intensity training, add 20, and then mm-hmm. at lactate high-intensity, add 25. So for example, mm-hmm. if your threshold was 140 beats per minute, at the top end of your lactate tolerance training, high intensity, you'd add 25 beats to that, so it'd be about 165.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then what I do is for recovery, we just do the 180 minus your age is the base recovery. And if mm-hmm. it's greater volume recovery, we minus 5 beats. And really low intensity aerobic conditioning, we minus 10 beats. So mm-hmm. I mm-hmm. not only do I graduate the intensity above threshold, I also graduate the decrease in intensity below threshold. So when I speak of moderate aerobic conditioning, what we're really doing is subtracting about 5 beats from that equation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Now question is. What results you're getting with this, especially in when they're performing, you feel like they're improving this way, or
well, what ends up happening really for the most part is most people have one thing that they do. They go out and either run hard or they run easy.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm trying mm-hmm. to do is I'm trying to graduate the progression of intensity above threshold. And do it Perfect. In a progressive fashion over time. So you're not going to just beat yourself up today and then come back and beat yourself up again tomorrow. You're going to massage your body with some aerobic conditioning between your efforts. You're going to mm-hmm. guard the intensity by including an adequate amount of recovery rather than perception. You're going to use heart rate to determine whether you're adequately recovered.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you start to spend greater lengths of time above threshold, you're going mm-hmm. to eventually start shoring up the amount of time that you get to recover and at,
okay.
the, and at the intensity you're going to get to recover. So I liken it to swimming underwater. If you want to get good at swimming underwater, you may go underwater and swim a little bit, have to come up, get a gulp of air, maybe two gulps of air, and then you're going to swim longer underwater. And the longer you're underwater, the more air you're going to need when you come up. And then progressively, as you start to improve your ability to sustain, essentially what it is you're sustaining all this carbon dioxide that's resident in your muscles and your body, and you get better at it. And so you're going to find that you could spend more time underwater with less and less recovery above the water.
So, in essence,
it's the same theory.
Yes.
Because
so it's safe to say that, for example, when you start them at sub-threshold workouts, whatever workout, that will be around, I don't know, like 10, 25% of the with the interval of rest, and then at a threshold workouts, it's going to be 50-75% of interval rest.
Well, there's varying ways to look at it. We can look at it in percentages, and it's really interesting because it took me a few days to do this because I was toying with the best approach to explain this to people. And I'm not terribly convinced I've got it yet, but what I've tried to do is I've tried to allow people to deal in time in the absence of having a heart rate monitor, which incidentally is a big mistake in my mind. I think that to do this properly, you need to wear a heart rate monitor.
I agree.
And so the idea being, so let me just kind of give you the broad stroke and then maybe I won't lose you. So I got it broken up into basically a couple weeks at a time. So the first 3 weeks, you do these 30-second intervals at high intensity with great recovery at very low heart rates. So, for example, if I found my threshold to be 140 beats per minute, my recovery heart rate would be minus 15. So probably about 130, 125 beats per minute would be the recovery. So the heart rate is governing the intensity. And incidentally, at the high end, we're looking at 25 beats above. So that would be 165. Mm-hmm. I'd have to recover down to 125 before I can repeat. So the length of time that I am recovering is what governs the work, right?
Yes.
As opposed to having a static amount of time where it may not be enough time, and you start to suffer later into the workout and no longer able to produce the intensities that you produced early on.
So, and so I'm not trying to interrupt, but that is exactly what we're seeing, though, in these type of events. These athletes, that's when, and like we mentioned a few minutes ago, that's when they start getting injured. They break form, and they're not trained at that thing. And I think this method that you're using is, it's outstanding. You should be writing more about this.
you know, I hate my writing, Harry. I got to be honest with you.
I got to go
into the editing and the whole thing. You got to love to write.
Yeah, I know. My writings are horrible too. But the way you're explaining it, if you take an average athlete, and meaning average in terms of the knowledge of training, and you explain it the way you're doing, I mean, you're going to have a very successful program, because that is the key piece that's missing in this type of event.
It's
someone that could explain it, and forget about percentages. You and I, we understand percentages, but just by having something visual like a heart rate monitor, they will start understanding the concept. You know, and then you manipulate the numbers. Obviously, when they start getting fitter, they'll notice that heart rate at rest is going to really drop faster. So that interval is going to stay shorter. And that's correct. That's the way to do it.
Well, and
you're on something here.
Thank you very much. So what I try to do is I progressively increase the amount of time under tension and reduce the amount of time recovering. But it's, you can't rush this process. If you just put a timeline on it where you said, well, this is a 10-week program, and in week 5, this is where I need to be, you're going to miss it, because if you're not governing the heart rate and allowing the body to adapt and develop your training program around your adaptations, then you're really going to screw the pooch. You're not going to get it done right.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So let me give you the broad stroke. I was trying to go there, and let me just finish it up. So I got it broken, segmented into like 3 weeks for the first phase, 2 weeks for the next phase, and another 2 weeks for the last phase. And I did it short like this because the other thing that happens with these obstacle racers, incidentally, is they have a full plate of events that they're into. They're not about to do like a marathoner might do, where you might schedule 22, 24 weeks worth of consecutive training preparing for an event. In 24 weeks, they made a race five times.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to make some sense of the time in between these events. So at least there's some systematic order in the approach to the training.
Absolutely.
So we can always revisit one of these phases, and relative to the results we're gaining, we're going to start understanding what phase we should actually be in when we finish up with an event. So in, again, so in the second phase, and by the way, the timeline is still pretty static. It's Monday, Wednesday, Friday is when the work is being done. Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday is when the recovery runs are being done. And so phase two, as I suggested, the intensity in the work is held longer by three times. So rather than 30 seconds, now it's 90 seconds. And the recovery time is about the same. So you're going to allow, if you get 90 seconds worth of work, you're going to get 90 seconds worth of recovery unless your heart rate's not come down to the stage that we're looking for.
Yes.
In which case you have to wait. And then if everything is going well, and the third phase of training, then what we're going to do is we're going to cut down the length of time under tension again, but we're going to increase the intensity again. So we went from high intensity to moderate intensity. Now we're going to go back up to high intensity, but we're going to sustain high intensity for longer. So high intensity work in the first phase was 30 seconds. Now in phase three, it's for 60 seconds. And the difference between phase three and phase one is not only is the intensity twice as much, but the recovery now is cut down to a third of what it was before. So where before it was like 1 to 2 or 1 to 3, now it's 2 or 3 to 1. So what you're doing is you're hoping, and you know, if everything goes as planned, by this time your need for recovery is going to be reduced, and your ability to sustain this high-intensity work for longer is going to be much more prolific. So,
Absolutely.
And
that,
then,
that's amount of weeks that you have them doing that, I think that's appropriate. You look at running, that's probably running not long distance or doing intervals for long, but mostly the 800 meter guy, the mile guy, that's tend to be a good way of doing it as well. You're correct.
Right. Well, and in essence, this is the thing, is that I believe in real world training. You know, you need to do something that is realistic. And I've seen a lot of programs that were written that were not really realistic. You know, they're complicated. They're very difficult. If you miss a week, you don't know where to go back into the program. And at the end of the day, what really is happening here, if the overtone of this, whether anybody's getting it or not, is that your heart rate recovery is what's dictating the process.
Absolutely. I agree.
It's the
all three components. You're right. The frequency, the duration, and obviously the intensity, which is heart rate. Absolutely.
Well, the point being is that if you're not seeing these responses from your recovery, then you're either approaching the work incorrectly or your body's not adapted. And if your body's not adapted, then all that's left for you to do is either allow more recovery or spend more time in that particular phase of training.
Absolutely. I have to agree. That's sort of the way we tend to do our athletes, our track guys, and also our middle distance guys. Absolutely. We base everything with heart rate.
The interesting thing about this, Harry, since you and I we share this type of work among each other, and because of the nature of the work we do, we understand the benefits and the importance of the type of work we're talking about. But what is traditional in most training environments, especially where running is concerned, is when they get onto a track, they've got these ambiguous workouts where they're mm-hmm. doing ladders. Well, okay, I'm going to run a 1,200, or I'm going to run an 800, a 600, mm-hmm. a 400, a 300, a 200. Now I'm going to run some hundreds. I got guys that are doing these 100-meter repeats with little rest mm-hmm. in preparation, late stages, to do a marathon.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to understand what crack they're smoking that would think that there's going to be some metabolic adaptations that are going to be beneficial by doing these really, really high-intensity workouts mm-hmm. with brief rest for a marathon.
Yeah, absolutely. I know you have heard of a gentleman who passed away, sir, a couple of decades ago, Arthur Lanyard.
Oh, yeah.
He never had any of his athletes do track work at 5 to 7 weeks before the event. That's the only time they did speed work. I mean, I was a big follower of his training. And all of his guys, they had to do track. It was, and I may be off by a week or so, but normally it was like 4 to 7 weeks prior to their event. That's when they started doing speed.
Well,
and it was speed. It was related to the event. It wasn't like, okay, let's do 100s now. You know, that's, I agree. Yeah, I agree with you totally.
Well, you know, the thing about Lydiard, since you brought it up, is that Lydiard was at a disadvantage. You know, he was a pioneer for his era mm-hmm. and his time. And one of the most potent comments he made, and I quote it often, is that the greater the base, the higher the peak.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's absolutely point on. Mm-hmm. In order to improve your capacity to go long, you mm-hmm. absolutely have to have a very powerful aerobic base. And mm-hmm. the disconnect, I think, is that his process is referred to as linear periodization training, where you spend a tremendous amount of time early on, as you suggested, doing base training, mm-hmm. and then mm-hmm. you progressively increase the intensity towards your event. Now, mm-hmm. the disconnect that I see here is that there's an assumption that you're going to maintain this base development you created early in your training.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But when you depart from that element of your process, you start to lose the benefits that were gained there. And I think that's a real problem. Now, what I suggested is him being a pioneer for his era, it's because he didn't have the advantage of monitoring heart rate when he was training folks, right?
Absolutely.
And mm-hmm. so the old expression is, whatever doesn't kill you will make you stronger. And the cream always rises to the top. So mm-hmm. what ends up happening is you may have a great percentage of the people that are very diligent in following your processes, and they do well by the work. And then your mm-hmm. assumption is, well, this training program rocks because my athletes are coming to the top and they're doing great. Well, mm-hmm. had he had the ability to monitor heart rate and add that component to his training processes, and then mm-hmm. adapt according to progression in your ability to sustain work, I think he would even mm-hmm. been more successful.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. Again, he was way ahead of his time. He was way ahead of his time. I had the honor in meeting him in literally several months before he passed away. I was down in Texas. I was doing some ACSN stuff, and he was there and in a different conference room. And I just, you know, went there and sat there, and he was just so way, way above his time, way above his time.
Right.
You know,
well,
he never knew the word intervals. He never knew anything about tempos or lactate. He was just run three quarters of whatever you feel, you know. it's amazing the way he was expressing all this. And now it's a lot of scientists, running scientists and coaches, that's the, you know, they obviously adapt their methods based on lineage.
Well, there's a lot of truth to be had behind his approach to training. And from a broad stroke, and in the absence of having another way to measure your progress, it's a very sound approach to training. And it's, you know, obviously enough, it's even to this day, and you know this, is that there's still a lot of mystery that surrounds heart rate training. And I had I actually had some comments with some people on Facebook just a moment ago where there were some questions about maximum heart rate. You know, the guy saying something like, I couldn't get my heart rate up past 195 beats per minute for the longest time. And just the other day, I hit 205. And my perceived exertion was less than it was when I was at 195. And my comment was, why are we having this conversation? I mean, really, you know, I tell people that your maximum heart rate's a moving target. It's, you know, you never know which way the wind blows when it comes to producing a maximum effort. Some days your heart rate will do it, some days you won't. But none of stuff is of any value from a training perspective. We don't spend training time at, you know, five beats short of our maximum effort.
No.
Any value anyway. So what's more important is your threshold, where your body shifts.
And that's, you know, as well as you know, that's the key for any type of adaptation. If you're a runner, if you're a swimmer, if you're, you know, and now with these CrossFit and the Spartan people, I mean, it's moving. It's understanding the workload and understanding the intensity of their event and the way you're doing your, and like I said a few minutes ago, you're writing about this and you're demonstrating it with your training, I think you're on the right path. And I think that if you could get even more specific with the actual cycles of training for these athletes, you should be writing about this. I'm telling you.
You know what it is that I promised some of the people that I'm training that I was going to put together a little spicy program for them. And so what I've suggested in the writing is that all training is cyclical. It's not linear. We don't start out at zero and continue infinity. There's going to come a point where we keep pushing, we break. And so what we want to do is we want to understand that, and we want to bypass that potential for failure by regressing and then progressing. So training should undulate. It should ebb and flow. And so, you know, I use the analogy of a weight trainer in the periodization process of developing strength. You know, you start out with lighter weights, you do more volume. And then you progressively do greater and greater weight and lesser volume. And then after you finish a cycle, you come back to your, for example, your 10 rep max. And lo and behold, your 10 rep max has improved by, you know, 20 pounds. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, the same thing occurs with your respiratory consequence and your metabolic adaptations, is that where you might have started out with a threshold of 140 beats per minute at the beginning of this program, and when you return to phase one again and reproduce the same efforts, you'll start noticing that either you're more efficient in your capacities to produce the work, or it's easier, or you can produce more and more effort, and then you build on that. But you have to regress in order to progress.
Yes, absolutely. And there's so many other components you could even use with these athletes. And we mentioned this in the first time we talk about resting heart rates and keep an eye in on that, and because that's a good sign of progression as well. And recovery, which we already mentioned, good recovery process. Not only passive but active recovery, which is very important for especially that type of event that these young athletes are trying to perform. Definitely.
Well, I can tell you that I have some athletes that I'm working with right now that are, this is their game. They're all into obstacle racing, and some of them, you know, earning money at it. They're professionals in the sport. And, you know, they came to me not because I am a professional in obstacle racing, but they identify that because obstacle racing represents about, running represents about 70 to 80% of the work you do during these races, is that if you're inefficient in your running, then the cost of work is magnified when you try to produce the power that you need to get through the obstacles. If you can lower the cost of your running, increase your pace relative to your cost, you can travel faster and have more energy when it comes time to approach these obstacles.
Absolutely.
So, again, as I suggested earlier, it was really entertaining for me to look at this problem and then try to develop some solutions around it. So the focus being that, you know, we could create, you know, your boilerplate approach to marathon training, which is inappropriate, I think, for these type of athletes. They need to learn to contend with this acidic environment. And, I mean, thus, this is why, you know, Sport Mask is on the map selling these guys these hypoxic masks to try to, you know, mimic altitude training. And, you know, teach them a way to approach the work so that they have a better handle on their capacities for taking it on or not. It's like, it's like if you go to a party and you know, okay, I can drink a beer, maybe two, and I'm cool to drive home. But if I take those four shots of tequila, I may not make it, right? You may have a problem. So, so what I look at this as is that these guys are taking the four shots of tequila and grabbing the keys and say, screw it, I'm going to try to get home one way or the other. You have to know your limitations.
I know. You're right. And I think based on what you're telling me also, going back to the actual training aspect, it's all sport specific. And this is an old term that we use for years and years, and I always believe in it. You know, you want to do an event in certain amount, you got to run a certain amount. And that's the way, and that's what you're doing. I mean, it's I can't wait to keep reading about it.
I'm going to send you a copy of it. I apologize, I haven't sent it to you right off, but I was.
We're busy. So
yeah.
No
well,
problem.
You know, I was pushing. I was pushing to get this done, and I really wanted to get this podcast out so that I could supplement the piece with a little bit of conversation around it. But at the end of the day, what I'm going to do is I'm going to make this available to people that subscribe to my podcast. I'm going to give it to them for free. And, you know, I'm going to use this template with some of the athletes I'm training right now. Already have been essentially following this. And now I'm getting reports from people. They're saying, hey, Richard, you know what? My heart rate's dropped dramatically while I'm doing da-da-da-da-da. More and more often I'm hearing people come back to me in the course of, you know, less than a month worth of effort. They're noticing response times that are dramatically improved. With their resting heart rate or recovery heart rate, and the capacity to improve the amount of work they could perform, and and to be honest with you, I don't think it's very, you know, it's not rocket science. I think it's just really number one, understanding how the body processes energy and adaptation, which I guess to some degree for some people that might be rocket science, but you know, anyway. So I'm just sharing what I think is a very sound approach to improving someone's capacity to survive this type of racing.
Yeah, absolutely. Another idea, in your next revision of your book, you should add a chapter on this type of training.
Well, at the end of the day, I look at this and I'm thinking, well, the fact that I've spent, you know, I got about 11 pages invested in this, it is a book unto itself. I mean, I could literally write a book on this topic. And as you suggested, I could expound on it and periodize the work over the course of a series of months and, you know, maybe even, you know, develop templates associated with specific distances you're preparing for. I don't know. Maybe if I can get a publisher to jump on it and front me the money to spend the time to invest in writing it, I'll do it. But, you know.
Sounds good.
It's like I tell people all the time, I get enough exercise in my day without having to, you know, waste a lot of exercise for no good reason.
Absolutely. I think you're onto something here. That's really good.
So we're going to get a chance. I'm sorry. We're going to get a chance to come out and visit you, Harry?
Yes. Well, yes. Like I mentioned, our meeting is next Tuesday. Your name is first on the list. I know they want you to come down. It's now trying to convince them about dates, and because the financial part, I think that's the easy part, to be honest with you. I think it's just really trying to figure out your schedule and when we could get you down here. But you will hear from me by next week.
Excellent. Well, look, Harry, I appreciate that we took you away from your client. I hope she's not upset with us.
Nah, she's fine. She's just sitting there waiting. That's no big deal.
Listen, tell her I wish her the best, and congratulations on having a baby and coming back to competitive sport.
Yes, she's very excited about it. She's going to rock this. You watch.
Well, look, again, let me let you go. I know you've got a client, and thanks so much for coming on the show with me today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. It was an honor, Richard.
You bet, buddy.
And best of luck. God bless.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, friends, it's time to bring another show to a close. Be sure and tune in to us next week. We've got a lot of great content in store for you. I want you to tell your friends to check us out. You can always find us on Facebook. Simply go search the Natural Running Network. Drop us a message. I'd love to learn more about you and the things you do. And until then, you have an amazing day.